Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here. We have, I believe, seven bills, if I remember correctly, or six bills, whatever it is, that we're going to hear today, public hearings. Some may go to work session, others will not. We will not be following the order that's on the agenda. I've got three members who are requesting to give testimony on three separate bills. So what I'm going to do is kind of get through those as the representatives are available. And I understand Representative Gelsler is here, so we're going to go ahead and start with that. So I'll open up a public hearing on 2433A. Bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2433 comes in from Representative Gelsler. What it does prohibits the courts from considering a person's disability when awarding custody or parenting time.
When you're ready.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for your record. My name is Sarah Gelsler. I'm the state representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. House Bill 2433 comes to you from the House. It's really a quite simple bill that talks about parenting time decisions and custody decisions when there is a parent with a disability that is involved. The bill seeks to ensure that a parent is not denied either custody or parenting time on the sole basis that they have a disability, whether that is a physical disability, whether that is epilepsy. It just wants to be sure that any parenting time or custody decisions are based on that parent's behavior and ability to care for that child. The bill would still allow disability to be considered, but only to the degree that the court finds that behaviors or limitations of the party related to the party's disability are endangering or will likely endanger the health, safety, or welfare of the child. And that is very simple bill, and that is what it does. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Sarah, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on 2433A? Bob? I also was just going to put on the record, I do have a vote explanation that was sent to my office from Representative Barnhart's office. He is scheduled, at least written down, to be giving testimony on another bill we're going to have today. But the vote explanation is for this bill, so we're going to leave this one open in the sense of giving him an opportunity if he wants to put anything on the record. Bob?
Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junda from Disability Rights Oregon. We support this bill. We worked with Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center to address some concerns in the wording to make sure that it was adequately protective of children, and we achieved that, we believe, in the 2433A. And so now we think that we've tailored it so that it just prohibits outright discrimination based upon disability, but it makes sure that any behaviors or abilities that a person has that interfere with their effective ability to either have custody of their child or to have visitation can be taken into account by the court.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? I would assume, Bob, before you stand up, just let me ask one. My understanding is that what the test will still be for the court is what is in the best interest of the child, understanding at the same time that solely they cannot, quote-unquote, discriminate against a parent based on just the disability itself.
That is correct, Senator Brzezinski.
All right, thank you. All right, we're going to go ahead and close for now the hearing on House Bill 2433. We may reopen that later this morning, depending on if Representative Barnhart wanted to put anything on the record. What we're going to go ahead and do is jump to House Bill 2143A, open up a public hearing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2143A comes to you from Representative Nathanson, removes the responsibility of the Department of Corrections to inspect local detention facilities, yet the county operating facility has initiated recent audit and provided certain information to the Department of Corrections, so retention is public records.
All right. I have Representative Nathanson may be joining us, but at this point I have Jeremiah Stromberg. Why don't you please come forward? Daryl Fuller and Patrick Singh.
Mr. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I've submitted testimony electronically, so you should have it available to you on OLS. House Bill 2143 didn't come from the Sheriff's Association. It came from an interim task force on state and local government efficiency. And as they looked at what state and local governments were doing, they discovered that there was a duplication in audits that occurred on county jails. Right now, there is a statutory requirement for the Department of Corrections to do an audit of county jails every other year. County jails do their own audit every year. The audit that we do is significantly more thorough than the statutory audit that's done by the Department of Corrections. So the Government Efficiency Committee said, well, why are we having the Department of Corrections do an audit that is already being done in the county jails? And the audit that the county jails do is not an internal audit. It is jailers from other counties who travel to a county and look at what they're doing. And the OSSA, it's done by our association, the OSSA audit has more than 300 points that they check to make sure that the jails are doing best practices. The DOC audit covers about 13 to 15 different points. And I have a copy of what the audit that the Department of Corrections does. I submitted it real early this morning, and so I don't know if it's on OLS or not, but it certainly will be available to you afterwards. So what we've agreed to do is, when we do the OSSA audit, is to take that portion of the audit that's required by statute to essentially fill out the form that the Department of Corrections would already be doing and send it to them. So the Department of Corrections still has the same information to ensure that the county jail is following its statutory requirements without having to actually send somebody from the Department of Corrections into the jail. It saves very little money, it saves very little time, but it was a duplication. And so we're happy to remove that requirement by the state. If a county jail is not doing the OSSA jail audit, then the Department of Corrections would still come in and do its audit every other year as it's required by statute. So the elimination of the Department of Corrections audit only occurs if it's being duplicated by the OSSA audit. The ACLU came to the House committee with amendments that would have required OSSA to turn over the entire 300-point audit to the Department of Corrections, as opposed to just that part of the audit which is currently required by statute. And the ACLU's suggestion is that the statutory requirements for the jails is insufficient. And they may be correct, but that was not the purpose of this committee, or the purpose of this bill. And if the ACLU wants to have a conversation during the interim about making the requirements in statute more robust, we're more than happy to have that conversation with them. We weren't prepared to do it in this bill. We let the ACLU know, we let the House committee know that if they want to have a conversation during the interim about maybe making the standards that are available more significant than the points that are currently in statute, then that may be a conversation worth having. I don't know when that statute was created, how old it is, or the purposes behind them. I don't know what other states do in terms of jail audits, but that may be an interesting conversation to have. But that's not a conversation that we were interested in having in this bill. So I guess with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you guys have.
Who would like to go next?
I can. Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg. I'm the Assistant Director of Community Corrections for the Department of Corrections. And in my current capacity, I oversee the inspection of the county jails, municipal and juvenile facilities, the temporary holds and lockups throughout the state of Oregon. The Department of Corrections does support this bill, which eliminates our responsibility to inspect the county jails, as it was just described, provided that that inspection takes place every other year. Yet it maintains the collaborative relationship between the Department of Corrections and the sheriffs, and I think Darrell did an excellent job of describing how we would continue to have oversight to see that the inspections were completed. We would retain the copies of those inspections in the same format as we currently do, and should those inspections not take place, then we would conduct them ourselves. And so with that, I appreciate your consideration of this bill, and we'll answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Singh. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, supporting House Bill 2143. I wanted to thank Representative Nathanson for her leadership on the interim task force. AOC worked in a leadership role with her in conjunction to make some of the recommendations on this task force. We had a criminal justice subcommittee of the task force that was chaired by Commissioner Mary Stern from Yamhill County. She's our association president this year. In addition to her, there were numerous city, county, and state officials who were part of the task force, either as members or as technical advisors. Just to share with you the diverse representation, the folks that were representing county governments, I'll list are Steve Atchison, the Columbia County District Attorney, Alex Kyler, Lane County Government Relations Manager, Faye Fagel, Marion County Juvenile Department Director and President of the Juvenile Department Directors Association, Laura Lee McKee, Lane County Deputy District Attorney, Jason Myers, Marion County Sheriff and President of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, Kiki Parker, Klamath County Community Corrections, and Scott Taylor, Multnomah County Community Justice Director and President of the Community Corrections Directors. The task force was staffed by AOC, and it's this particular bill is identified as one of the top priorities from our AOC Public Safety Committee. A few key points about the amendments that were worked into the engrossed bill. As directed by the task force, the bill handles county jails only, so not municipal holding cells or juvenile department cells. And it's important to note that according to the task force report that we received, and perhaps Director Stromberg can correct me if I'm wrong, DOC conducted many of these audits in conjunction with the peer county audit teams that were provided by the OSSA. So there was that clear duplication that we are trying to eliminate with this bill. Also on the over 300 points that the State Sheriff's Association conducts their audits under. We too, AOC, would be happy to join in on a discussion as to what we'd like to see our audit structure be and if we want to increase it from the current 14 points. But I will point out that from what I understand, many of the areas that are covered in the State Sheriff's report are not only confidential, but have to do with a lot of public safety measures. So I think there are a few of us on this side of the room, a handful of us who work in some law enforcement capacity. I work as a reserve police officer in the city of Portland, so I, on a semi-regular basis, get to process folks through the jail system, through a county jail, and there are a lot of parts in that process that relate to inmate security and safety and public safety and processes that should not be released to the public, but would be helpful in terms of peer auditing functions. So again, we'll support a longer term conversation, but we do support the bill and urge your support.
Thank you. Questions?
I've got a couple.
I do, but
go ahead, Senator Dingfelder.
Yeah, thank you. I was wondering if you could talk about, I'm just looking right here, it doesn't specify in the bill, but criteria between the difference in the audits. I think you discussed, Daryl, that these were done by sheriffs, other sheriffs' office, is that correct? So is there, can you tell me what the distinction is between the criteria that's used in the different audits? Because what I'm trying to figure out is, I understand about greater efficiency, but want to make sure we're not sacrificing transparency.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dingfelder, and I can get more specific information if you want it. The Department of Corrections Community Corrections Division audit report is simply a yes or no checkoff form. It asks things like, when was the last time the state fire marshal inspected the facility and did it pass, as an example? Does it have a, was the fire sprinkler system checked? The fire alarm checked? Has the health department been by? Has a grand jury gone through and inspected the courts as required by law? So there's just, it's a list of yes or no's that are required by statute to make sure that the jail is minimally functional. Okay. The OSSA audit covers all of those points, but substantially more. We get into best practices minutia that is far beyond what is required just to make sure that you have a minimally secure and humane jail. We get into cost efficiency issues. We get into not only inmate management, but staff management and contract employee management, volunteers, and just all of the processes that go in to make sure that our jails are running efficiently. But that the inspection that we do through OSSA more than covers all of the points that are covered in the Department of Corrections audit. As Mr. Singh noted in his testimony, a lot of times when the OSSA jail audits committee is going into a jail to do an inspection, they will invite the Department of Corrections to come in at the same time so that they can do their checkoff while we're doing our audit, so that it's all done at the same time, and the jail only has to be disrupted one time for that process. So what the bill would simply do is give the OSSA jail audit team the ability to fill out the Department of Corrections form for the Department of Corrections rather than them having an employee having to be there through that process.
Thank you. That's helpful.
All right. So let me follow up with a couple others. Jeremiah, this may be for you. Regarding the default, if for some reason a county is scheduled to have their facility reviewed, and if you don't, I mean, what's going to be the protocol or procedure to make certain you get what you need from the sheriffs? And if it doesn't happen, what's the time frame before you're going to take steps to go do the review?
Chair Przanski, we haven't worked out what that exact agreement would look like. To answer it today in front of the committee, I would set and put into place, we currently have a schedule of when each of the county facilities are due for an inspection. So we would continue to maintain that checklist over the two-year period as to who is due and when we typically would have been going in to conduct our audit. I would propose that if we didn't receive, we could do a number of things. Send out a 30-day notice that this jail is due for inspection, and then within 30 to 60 days following, reach out again to find out if that inspection took place, and if it didn't, then we would move to conduct the inspection. So again, we haven't worked together yet to set up a protocol, but it would certainly be simplistic enough and not require any additional resources on our behalf to continue to monitor whether or not these inspections and audits are taking place.
All right. I think that's the important thing for the chair, and I think for the committee, making certain we don't see stuff fall through the cracks. And
absolutely.
To understand the rules haven't been set up, or to say the discussions about how this will be done. But one of the things we would like for you to do is, once you get that together, to report back, because if we need to, for whatever reason, look at this during the interim session, and 14 will be able to do that. So, other questions? Patrick, you mentioned something about this doesn't cover municipal, you said holding cells or other juvenile type of holding facilities. There are municipal jails, not holding cells. How are those? I mean, right, my understanding is the county actually does that. The commissioners have been going through, but I'm not sure if that's still the protocol for jail facilities that are operated by cities.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I believe the Department of Corrections would continue to audit all facilities except for county jails.
Right.
And Chair Przanski, that is correct. We would continue to do all other facilities in the state, not run under the authority of the sheriffs.
All right. So at this point, DLC basically has a jurisdiction. Okay.
Yes.
And the last is, I think we pretty well got there, Daryl, as to the explanation of the 300 points, understanding greater detail. I would like to have that, I think, made available so we can actually just see what is currently there for OSAA type of review. So we'll have that part of our record as well.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I'd be happy to provide a copy of, it's a copyrighted document, so we're not able to just make copies and distribute them, but I'd be happy to bring a copy for you guys to review, and you guys can look through it's a pretty thick three-ring binder full of information.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not looking for the actual internal documentation, but at least you probably have a checklist, that there are some type of list that you're checking off as you're going across it. I mean, that's what I'm trying to see. If
yeah.
there's like a summary or something we can get?
Mr. Chair, I've seen the actual binder. I'll see if there's a summary of it or an index or something that would answer your question. I'd be happy to provide it.
I think that would be important for the question that Senator Dingfelder asked. And I will let them. Is there any other questions? We got two other people. I'm going to go ahead and let them testify. Then I've got some points I want to make regarding what I hope will happen during this current upcoming interim period. So, Representative Nathanson, why don't you come forward? And if you don't mind sharing the dais, Dave Danke's here. I'd like to have Dave come up if that's all right.
Okay. Hello.
Hi.
Should I begin? Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, House Representative, Representative House District 13. As you've heard, I'm bringing you this bill from the State and Local Government Efficiency Task Force. I'm not going to repeat everything that has been said, but I do want to underscore a few things. The most important thing is that we were looking at a situation where the jails are being audited under one set of standards that include 309 facets of jail operations. The state audit was much less thorough. It was only 14 things that you just check off. So that was the first thing that we focused on. One audit is very, very thorough. The other seems pretty cursory and superficial in comparison. Another thing to point out is I did ask to see that binder. I had the same kinds of questions you did. It is a very thick binder. As I combed through it, I saw, first of all, the 14 standards that the state audit covers include topics like staffing sufficient to provide security, control, custody, and supervision. Are there written policies? And then it asks about nine topics, such as medical procedures and medication, release process, telephone calls, visitation, meals, clothing, and emergency plans. The county sheriff's audit book that I took a look at, as was mentioned, it's copyrighted, and you don't just make copies of the whole binder, but I did ask to look, and in perusing it, I saw in the 164 pages that I quickly thumbed through, I saw detailed instructions, advice, and best practices on many different topics. For example, daily hygiene, biohazard training for staff, volunteers, community resources like religious services, frequency and duration of exercise, proper laundering, cross-gender searches, inmate accessible areas, and inmate rules. A very, very wide array of things that are being covered in those 309 topics. I also wanted to mention that in the issue of what information should be released, what we tried to do was craft a bill that said whatever information has been available to the public already should remain available to the public. So anything that would have been involved in those 14 standards that the state has been doing should be available. If there's an issue about should more information be available to the public, I would suggest that that's a policy discussion that could happen on a different day in a different bill. This bill was not about the policy of releasing information. It was merely about trying to save resources and get a little bit more efficient administratively in how the processes are done. So I'm hoping that if there is a policy question about information, that that could be saved for another discussion. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I'm not sure what your schedule is. Can you stay for...
I can stay a few minutes.
All right. Dave, why don't you give us your testimony, then we'll open up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm David Fidanke, Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon, here pinch-hitting today for our Legislative Director, Becky Strauss.
We want to thank you for being here. We understand that there's a concern that you may have overslept, but apparently you didn't, so we'll make sure Becky knows that you are here.
Thank you.
That's a little too much information, Mr. Chair.
The email, it's public record. What can I say?
I admit I was in Portland until very late last night. You have written testimony from Ms. Strauss. I hope it was emailed to the committee last night. And, you know, I think the bottom line is that the ACLU's concern is, as has been, I think, correctly transmitted to you in Mr. Fuller's testimony is about the overall system. The standards in the state statute, I believe, were adopted in the 1970s, really haven't been reviewed in many, many years. And we're delighted that the sheriffs are doing these, what have been submitted to us are assurances that these audits are very comprehensive. But they are secret audits. Those carried out by the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. We have requested copies of the sheriff's criteria. The Sheriff's Association has refused to provide those to us for some of the same reasons that Mr. Fuller mentioned this morning. We do not believe that eliminating a public system for a secret system is a good trade-off. We would be delighted to have further conversations about this, but we don't feel that we can either support this legislation or be neutral on it until that conversation has taken place. When the sheriff's audits are completed, the sheriff in the county where the audit has taken place is given a report that merely says that, you know, criteria Roman numeral 1 sub A sub I is deficient. There is nothing in that report that says what even area of the jail or of the standards is involved. It's written in code. If you have the code book, you can decipher it. The public has no window into this process currently, and there are a lot of resources, albeit diminishing resources at most county levels. The state also covers the costs of incarceration in local jails for many felons who are sentenced. So, you know, I'm sorry for you know, Representative Nathanson's having to bear the burden of us coming in to have this discussion, but there really hasn't been a platform to even begin the discussion until Representative Nathanson and her task force brought forward this proposal. So we hope the committee will take our concerns seriously and that we will be able to bring more transparency to the operations of our local jails and other detention facilities, bring the standards up to date, and make sure that the public knows that these facilities are being operated in a manner that is consistent with the law and the Constitution.
Thank you. Senator Dingfelder, you still have a question?
I just wanted to thank Representative Nathanson for her hard work on this and bringing it to our attention, and obviously we'll need to spend a little more time on it, but as usual, she's right there looking at how we can make government more efficient and effective, so thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Dave, I'm confused. This bill, I mean, you're bringing up some legitimate issues, but potentially going forward, all this bill does is get us to a level of efficiencies. It doesn't change what's discoverable now in any way, shape, or form. So I can understand you wanting to have a platform for other discussions, but I'm confused as to how that intersects with this bill, because what is public information now will be public information afterwards. We're just eliminating some administrative functions, as I understand the bill. So where's the objection to doing that?
Chair Przanski and Senator Cruz, we don't have an objection to that.
Okay.
We do believe the current standards are insufficient under the state statute. This will maintain the status quo. Our fear is that once this bill is passed, this issue will go away and will not be reviewed again for another 20 or 30 years. And in the meantime, the standards by which our jails are operating on a daily basis is largely secret and hidden from public view.
Follow up.
Yep.
This is probably for Representative Nathanson. For example, if DOC did a modification of their standards, it would be incumbent upon the sheriffs to match that modification, I would assume. Am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair and committee, yes, I believe that's true, because there will be some sort of agreement between DOC and the Sheriff's Association on what they're expecting to be covered. So if the sheriffs were unable or unwilling to do that, then DOC would be back in the business of either conducting the full audit on its own or going back in to review this one point, perhaps, that they had modified or added.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Dingfelder.
Sorry, I just thought of one that
just came out. It's my fault. I shouldn't have asked questions.
It's true. Actually, and I don't know if it might be better to ask the sheriff's office this, but with the budget cuts, and particularly in Southern Oregon, you know, one thing that occurred to me is if we're asking sheriff's office to do these audits, is that going to be a problem for?
It's actually the association.
Okay.
And the association, some of what I heard from the conversation from Mr. Fuller was basically they have a group of different people from different counties that make up the review teams. So I would assume that they would have to facilitate different people to participate in that may have, if they are no longer employed.
Right. I was thinking that probably means that we won't have many people.
And the fallback is that Director of Corrections comes in and does it. So I mean,
I would suggest the audit of the Curry County jail, which may be down to one little room,
be pretty
won't take a whole lot of time.
Well, and that was the other, just making sure that there is a safety, you know, fallback that if, yeah.
Okay.
All right.
So let me make a couple. Did you want to say something? I just saw your hand go up. Okay, let me go ahead and make a couple of comments here. First, let me find out, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 2143A? All right, not seeing anyone. What we're going to do is, at this point, I'm ready to move the bill forward. I don't know if we have all the paperwork, but if we don't, we'll get that. What I do want is to have this ongoing conversation. I do believe it's time for us to look at policy-wise where we're at. And so as I was saying in my opening comments and on the first panel, I do expect that there's going to be some type of interim work to look at this to see what we're going to make certain what we're doing is appropriate. I understand the position that the association may be taking as a quote-unquote private association as to what they may have as copyright, but I think you're getting into a very interesting area when you're using a private association to come in and do governmental function work and then say, well, we can't make this available or whatever. I think there's transparency issues there, so we'll need to be looking at that as well. And then I guess lastly for Dave, Becky had asked for us to put this over so she could come and testify. We did tell her that we would allow the bill to stay in the committee so she could make it here. She probably didn't give you that message, and that's why you're here this morning.
No, I had that message.
So would she do, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing, but do you want the record to stay open for her to be able to make other comments, or have you pretty well covered them?
I think we've pretty well covered it. Thank you, Chairman.
All right, thank you.
Is there an additional amendment to this bill?
To this bill, not that I know of.
Okay, so the -3s was incorporated, that's in the A?
That is correct. That's what Patrick, I think, was discussing.
Unfortunately, Olis is down, so I'm looking.
Oh, wow. All right, so we'll close the public hearing, and do we have all the paperwork, Bill?
Chairman of the committee, yes, we do. That's the advantage of the second chamber.
All right, just making sure. So we're open for work session on 2143A. And the chair will take a motion on moving the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2143A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2143A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
It's tough to make the transition.
It is.
I get my mind there. Maybe next week. Any discussion? Besides what I've said, I favor the bill. I do believe that we do need to have the continual review just to see how our policy after 30 to 40 years is actually carried out as to the norms of today in this arena. Any other discussions?
Just that Mr. Chair, I appreciate those comments. I will just add that this is a trend that we're seeing more and more in government, where we're asking associations or NGOs to conduct government business, and I think this issue about transparency, I think, will be a continued conversation, but I appreciate the comments that the Chair made and support that.
All right. Any objections? So ordered. The Chair will carry the bill to the floor. And just for the record, and for those who are here or those watching, Senator Close has been excused from judiciary today. That is why she's not here. And, of course, she's excused from all the votes. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 2143A. And we're going to go ahead and open up public hearing on House Bill 2378. And what I'm going to do, Bill, go ahead and give us that.
Sure.
Overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2378 comes to you from Representative Barnhart. It allows a parent or guardian of a minor to file a petition with a circuit court seeking appointment of a guardian for the minor that is effective when the minor becomes an adult. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is some ambiguity in the situation of when a minor who has a parent or a guardian, when they become 18, whether that guardianship continues, and this would clarify the issue, that you can go to court before they're 18 to seek the guardianship after they turn 18.
Okay. And we have Sonia Carlson here on behalf of Representative Barnhart. Sonia, why don't you come up? I have another individual that's lined up. It's Teresa, I don't know if it's Lemire or Lamar. I can't read. Lemire? Okay. While y'all are getting situated, I do want to go back to the other bill that was 2433A. Wasn't sure whether or not Representative Barnhart wanted to give testimony. He did, in fact, submit a voter explanation for the bill from the floor. That will be part of the record. We do not need to have that read into the record. It will be part of the record. So let's go ahead and go back to our public hearing here on 2378. Sonia?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sonia Carlson, and I'm Representative Barnhart's Chief of Staff. He unfortunately couldn't make it this morning as he's in revenue and otherwise engaged today.
Making money.
We bring you 2378 at the request of a constituent, Teresa Lemire. She can share more of her story with you. We do believe that House Bill 2378 clarifies a law that many of the circuit courts already use as standard practice.
Chair Przanski and the committee, we'd like to thank you for allowing us to share our story this morning. My daughter, Melissa Wimmer.
Teresa, I need you to put your name on the record.
Teresa Lemire.
Thank you.
Okay. My daughter, Melissa Winna, is diagnosed with stroke, Fragile X syndrome, Turner syndrome, and a large number of related diagnoses. And we have known since she was very young that the combination of her developmental delays and her physical disabilities would make it impossible for her to live independently. We also knew that we would need to apply for guardianship to ensure her safety and guide her medical care and other legal responsibilities. We had a meeting with our attorney 4 months before Melissa's 18th birthday. She was surprised we were so early, and we were shocked to realize that in Oregon, you cannot apply for guardianship before the individual's 18th birthday. Having your severely disabled child turn 18 is an emotional roller coaster. Your friends' children are planning for college. They're moving into their apartments, and they're planning for their future. We were planning for the future, too. But for us, it meant going to the court and asking in order to keep our daughter safe, to take control of her legal rights. It is something that no family does lightly. For medically fragile young adults in Oregon, the issues are even greater. Because we cannot file prior to the child's 18th birthday, there can be a significant period of time where no one has legal authority. The individual is not able to make decisions for themselves. The parents are no longer able to make decisions, and medical providers cannot make decisions either. In our case, we applied for guardianship on September the 6th, 2011, and Melissa's legal status was in limbo until our request was granted on September the 30th. She was seen by 5 doctors during that time, any one of which could have refused us care, and narrowly avoided a hospitalization where no one would have had legal authorities to make decisions regarding her medical care. Our attorney told us that in a crisis, an appeal can be made to the court, and the judge could have made decisions for Melissa. It's hard to explain how stressful this time was for our family. We were dealing with the emotional reality of Melissa's future, very worried she would need medical care, which would lead to a legal crisis, and also managing her day-to-day care. Much of the stress that a family with a medically fragile and disabled child faces is unavoidable. This bill, which would allow families to request guardianship 90 days prior to their child's 18th birthday, can remove a large burden from families like ours. I'm asking you that you make a very challenging time easier for Oregon families and support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for coming forward. Thank you for telling us your story. Questions? Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on 2378? Not seeing anyone, we're closing the public hearing, opening a work session on House Bill 2378.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2378 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2378 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Cruz, would you be carrier of this? Senator Cruz will carry the bill on the floor. We'll close the work session on 2378. And we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing on House Bill 2053.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2053 comes to you from Governor Kitt's offer. It allows a Native American tribe to request from the Oregon State Police a criminal background check on a person who is seeking to be certified by the tribe to provide foster care. Permits the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Health Authority, the Employment Division to require the fingerprints of the person the Native American tribe would be certifying for foster care.
I have two people that have signed up to give testimony this morning, Harry Gilmore and Justin Martin. Why don't you two come up while they're coming up? Is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on 2053? Gentlemen, whoever would like to get started.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name's Harry Gilmore. I manage the Interstate Compact and Contracts Unit for the Department of Human Services. The department supports House Bill 2053. First and foremost, passage of this bill will ensure the safety of children in tribal foster care by allowing tribes to conduct thorough criminal background checks on prospective foster parents. These are the same background checks that the Department of Human Services currently conducts on foster parents that are certified by DHS. Not only that, this particular type of background check, which is a fingerprint-based national check of criminal records, is required by federal law for any entity that accepts Title IV-E funds to support their foster care program, which DHS does, and tribes that have a foster care program also use Title IV-E funds. So this will not only ensure the safety of children, but ensure the continuance of the federal monies that support foster care programs generally. It does this in two ways. It allows the tribes to conduct the background checks themselves through the Oregon State Police. Tribes already have the legal authority to conduct background checks on individuals who work in the gaming industry or for law enforcement purposes. This just expands the list in statute of subject individuals who can be subject to a background check by a tribal, by an Oregon tribe. It also, for tribes that do not have a mechanism for conducting background checks, it would allow the tribe to use the Oregon Department of Human Services background check unit to conduct essentially the same check. So it gives the tribes two options. If they have a mechanism and the ability to run the checks themselves, the law will allow them to do that. It also expands the list of entities that the Department of Human Services can run checks on behalf of. We already run checks for licensed agencies, for a number of different private entities that serve vulnerable populations, and this would just add tribes to that list of entities that the department can run checks on behalf of. The tribes support this bill. We work with them directly on its formulation, and they've pledged their support. I thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Justin?
Good Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. You've heard from Harry pretty much the details of the bill, and you've got my testimony in front of you, so I won't take too much of the committee's time today. But we are here in support of House Bill 2053. We would ask for your support. And in terms of the government-to-government relationship, you guys have probably heard me say this a million times, but it's something that we here in Oregon are very, very proud of. Oregon is truly unique in looking at the government-to-government relationship. We believe that House Bill 2053 continues that unique relationship and continues moving Oregon forward with a vision that not a lot of states have. And as Senator Roblin knows, we are very proud of that. The government-to-government cluster has worked very well together to bring pieces of legislation like this in front of the legislature. And again, we ask your support of 2053. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Dinsmore.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Two questions. One has to do with, I heard that you said you had worked with the tribes on this. Did you also discuss this with NAIA, Native American Youth Association, or I'm not sure the exact title of their, and the reason I bring that up is because they are not in my district, but I've worked closely with them over the years, and actually Nicole Mayer, the former executive director, was the one who really enlightened me about the overrepresentation of Native American children in our foster care system and the need to, and I know this bill does not address this directly, but the need for greater education with our foster families about, you know, cultural issues, especially with Native American children. So I know that NAIA has been very involved working with DHS and foster care system.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dingfelder, I personally haven't been working with NAIA on this, but I would assure you, even though NAIA is not part of the actual government-to-government process and part of the Health and Human Services cluster, again, we continually have those conversations, and we have had those conversations in the past with them.
NAIA was not part of our direct meetings with tribes. We have a quarterly meeting between Department of Human Services, Child Welfare specifically, and tribal representatives. And NAIA was not specifically represented at those meetings, so I haven't had those direct conversations. But I personally, I don't think that there would be a reason that they would oppose this concept, because it does benefit the tribes and it does ensure child safety.
And Mr. Chair, if I may follow up, I don't think so either, but I just want to remind you and encourage you, because especially in the urban area where we have the largest, one of the largest populations, if not the largest, Native American families actually in urban areas, and NAIA serves a lot of those families and the kids, and especially foster kids that are in the urban area. So I just encourage you to reach out to them. I certainly think this is in line with the type of cultural specific training and issues that I've heard them raise, but just want to encourage you to do that.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Roblin.
Yeah, mostly just a comment. And, you know, I agree that getting input from NAIA and some of the other Native organizations in the area is always helpful in these things, but the reality is we can't have and don't have a government-to-government relationship with those other groups, and we have a government-to-government relationship with the nine tribes, and that's who we relate with, that's who we, as a government-to-government, work with. I understand and clearly recognize that we need to continue to work with all of the tribes, but I think in this particular kind of thing, when we're giving sensitive information to somebody, they have to have a government in place that can do that, and I think this is the appropriate bill. Having those conversations is always important, but there are times when it really has to be government to government, and this is one of those, in my opinion. So just a comment, and I appreciate the bill.
All right. Any other questions or comments? No one else wanted to give testimony today on 2053, if I heard correctly, so I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing, open the work session on 2053.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2053 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2053 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Questions? Objections? So ordered. Senator Dingfelder requests to carry the bill.
Sure.
You will be our carrier. And I'll close the work session on 2053. I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on the bill we had earlier, 2433. All right. This is one that we had regarding the prohibiting a court from considering a person's disability when awarding child custody or parenting time. I had left this open to allow Senator, Representative Barnhart to come forward if he wanted to, but we have adopted his vote explanation as part of it. So I'm ready to go ahead and move the bill unless we have other questions. Senator
Mr. Chair, in a conversation I had with Representative Nathanson, I think the objections on the floor, there was some confusion as to people were looking at the original bill, not the amended version, and I think those who still voted no, it was just as a matter of caution, not objection, just wanting to make sure that we were paying attention when it came to our side. So,
and I agree. That's what Representative Barnhart's vote explanation basically said. He was voting no out of caution.
Yes.
So if there's not any other discussion, any objection?
You need a motion
take
first.
Take a motion first.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2433A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2433A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Roebling, will you be the carrier?
Yep.
And we'll close the work session on 2433A. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2234.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2234 comes from the governor's office. Eliminates the sunset provision that allows offenders in post-prison supervision to be placed in an active status. The chairman of the committee, this was originally enacted in House Bill 3508 in the 2010 session. We put a sunset provision on it, and this removes the sunset provision.
All right, thank you. We'll go ahead and call up Jeremiah Stromberg again and Scott Taylor. While they're coming forward, is there anyone else who will want to testify on 2234?
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Again, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg, Assistant Director of Community Corrections with the Department of Corrections. House Bill 2234 removes the July 1st, 2013 sunset for local control offenders moving to inactive status. In 2011, the legislature passed Senate Bill 75 to extend the sunset for local control offenders to move to inactive status after half of their sentences served, unless the parole officer requests the offender remain on active supervision. In order for an offender to be considered for inactive supervision, they must be in compliance with all the conditions of their supervision and have paid in full any restitution or compensatory fines. This practice will align the laws governing inactive status for post-prison supervision under the local supervisory authorities with those governing the same practice under the Board of Parole and post-prison supervision. There is no negative fiscal impact associated with this bill. Rather, it is a cost savings to the community corrections budget, and based upon the number of offenders who may be eligible in the next biennium, it's estimated that that savings could be approximately $887,000. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Scott.
Senator Przanski, committee, my name is Scott Taylor. I'm the president of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the director of Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. We're just here. Jeremiah has covered the basics of the bill. We're in support of it. We think it matches evidence-based practices. We also think that it makes it simpler for our officers when we have a consistency between what the board, those on post-prison supervision, and those that are on local control PPS, when as much as we can align those together. And so we support the bill.
Thank you. Any questions for either individual, Senator Dingfelder?
I just had a question about the number. You said you talked about the savings, but can you tell me how many folks we're talking about? How many?
Chair Przanski, Senator Dingfelder, I can tell you that between 2009, mm-hmm. January of 2009, and October of 2012, there were 544 offenders that had been moved to the inactive status under the original House Bill 3508. I don't have in front of me right now what number we believe are going to be eligible. I only had the fiscal amount, but I can certainly provide for you what the number of offenders we believe going forward would at least be eligible. Again, the onus is on them to comply with all the conditions of their supervision and pay any and all restitution in full. And so our estimates are based solely on those that would be eligible during this next biennium on local control status.
Thank you. You answered my next question, which was going forward, and is restitution paid in full, and making sure that, getting on the record, it doesn't affect restitution.
Yes, Senator. Absolutely. It's a requirement for consideration.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
No.
All right. Thank you. Again, is there anyone else? Bill?
If this bill were not to pass, how much would this cost the Department of Corrections?
Well, they said the savings was $800.
Right. Yeah. So I'm assuming that's what the cost would be.
So, Chair Przanski, Council, yes, the bill provides a savings, if it passes, of $887,000. Without the inactive status, those that remain on active status become part of the count that we take every other year to determine the community corrections budget. And so if you're on inactive status, you're not a part of the count. We're not... spending money on you, and therefore you're not going to be considered in that capitated rate in the community corrections budget. And so ultimately, the piece that I don't have complete clarity on is if the April forecast considered the sunsetting of this bill or not. And so that would answer the question whether or not there's a impact the other way. Did I confuse that enough for you? All right.
Clear as mud. Thank you.
All right.
All right. Any other questions, comments, thoughts, or want to put anything else on the record? All right. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2234. Open up a work session on House Bill 2234.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2234 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2234 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions? Any objections? No discussion either, I assume. So I'm trying to get past that one. Chair will carry that one. We'll close the work session on 2234. This will bring us to, I believe, our last hearing for today, House Bill 2049. Bill?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2049 comes to you from Governor Kitzhoffer, allows juvenile community supervision officers to take into custody a youth who has violated parole, or requires a juvenile community supervision officer to bring a youth under 18 to a juvenile detention facility. The chair, members of the committee, we also received this morning the dash one amendments to this bill.
All right. I have just one, a number of people who want to give testimony, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to call up first Philip Cox, Scott Taylor, and Alex Kyler will be the first three. And as they're getting set, I just want to put a couple things on the record. The Dash One amendments were requested through my office at the request of Lane County, who was, in my understanding, making a request for the consortium of larger counties that have youth associations or authorities that are working together on different regional type of issues. So at this point, I have had a conversation with the OYA yesterday as to those amendments. I told them then I was going to ponder as to what, if anything, we wanted to do with those. I am going to put some things on the record as to once we get to this point, because I think there's some things that just need to be said, and then we'll decide on what, if anything, is going to happen to the Dash One amendments at our work session. So who would like to start? Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Philip Cox, Oregon Youth Authority Assistant Director of Community Services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2049, a bill filed at the request of the Governor on behalf of the Youth Authority. House Bill 2049 provides OYA juvenile community supervision officers the authority to take into custody OYA parole youth offenders when there's an active warrant issued by the superintendent of an OYA youth correctional facility. Current statute provides OYA juvenile community supervision officers the ability to take youth offenders on probation into custody when authorized by a juvenile court. However, statute does not provide similar authority to take into custody youth offenders on OYA parole. Currently, only law enforcement officers may apprehend and deliver OYA parolees to juvenile detention centers or adult jails. This creates unnecessary workload for law enforcement agencies, which could efficiently and effectively be handled by OIA juvenile community supervision officers. House Bill 2049 allows for the most efficient use of resources in ensuring public safety and accountability by specifically authorizing agency staff to take parolees into custody on an OIA warrant for parole violation. This bill has no impact on the current policies or training of OIA officers, since they currently are given authority by juvenile courts to take OIA probation youth offenders into custody. There's no fiscal impact from this bill, and as I indicated earlier, it creates public safety efficiencies that can result in cost savings to local law enforcement agencies. Again, I would reiterate that House Bill 2049 only provides custody authority to OIA staff on warrants issued by OIA youth correctional facility superintendents for violating conditions of parole. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm pleased to answer any questions you or members of the committee might have.
All right. Thank you. Scott?
Senator Prozanski, members of the committee. I'm Scott Taylor. I'm the director of Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, and I also have been working in a consortium of five counties that have been interested in the opportunity that's allowed in statute currently to manage the parole population at the local level for OIA. We've been in discussions for a number of years about that topic. We have not yet reached agreement, but we particularly support this bill, and we support the Dash Ones because we think it continues to allow the opportunity, should that happen, should OIA decide that that makes sense. We wouldn't want our staff to be limited in their capacity to be able to carry out the same duties that, as it remains under state management, they have. So we are in support of the Dash Ones and the bill overall.
All right. Alex?
Thank you, Chair Prozanski. Members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. As the Chair indicated, it was a request from my office that came for the Dash 1 amendment. My understanding of that was after the bill came through the House, there were some concerns raised about what the implications of the bill were. There was a meeting over at the local government center on the, I believe, the 22nd of March to discuss. There was some back and forth between the department and the counties that attended. And then the request came to me to seek the amendment. The Board of County Commissioners did, I brought this in front of the Board of County Commissioners, as is our process, through our legislative committee to get approval to seek the amendment. And I think we would have Marion County here speaking in support of this, except they have not gone through that process of through their Board of County Commissioners to get that same level of approval. As Mr. Taylor indicated, we are part of a consortium that has been working for a number of years to try to explore different methodologies where there could be a partnership between OIA and the counties on the parole services. I think clearly the focus at both agencies is on this youth population, and my experience within this building and down at Lane County, the stories and the examples of kids turning their lives around is just really truly remarkable. And I think that the parties have shared that goal in these conversations is the best outcomes for youth. This amendment, we believe, doesn't derail the utility of the bill for the purposes of the youth authority that have been expressed by Mr. Cox. Clearly the Dash 1 state that only does this provision come into play if there is a contract between the two agencies.
All right, thank you. I'm gonna start off here because I feel like the way this amendment has come around was not in the best way and process. I hear that we have a consortium that wants to work with the state, who wants to take on these various duties, but there's no communication, from what I understand, from the consortium to OIA before yesterday or the day before. My office, I think, was contacted because I'm the chair, and they asked me to do it as and not instead of going through the staff here. Judiciary staff did not know about this amendment until this morning, so I take some responsibility for my office not getting there, but at the same time, this was probably a more appropriate request that should have come through the committee administrator instead of necessarily the chair's office. What I am hesitant on is I'm trying to figure out how we are ever going to get the communication at the county local level with the state when we, it seems like everyone is trying to position themselves, gaming to some level, to the point of where we have an amendment at this point that does not do anything except if in the in the future there's going to be a contract. Because my understanding at this point, OIA does not have any contracts with any counties to oversee anyone that's being released from OIA. And so it's kind of like if in the future we need something, we've got it in place. And my discussion yesterday when OIA came aware that this amendment was out there, that they have no intention at this point to actually enter into those contracts. Then I come back to the question, if we're really trying to get everyone together, have open communication, and actually work together for the best interest of the kids, why aren't we discussing? So those are my frustrations and my points I want to put on the record. So anyone else have questions or comments?
Yeah.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only comment is I really do hope that the community corrections and the counties and this group continue to talk and work it out. But I think us to take action on an amendment that came this way would actually say we're picking on one side or another. It isn't about sides. It's about doing the right thing for kids. And I hope that they can eventually figure out how to all work together and make it work. That'd be great. But currently, I don't think it's, for me, it's not the appropriate deal. Almost exactly the same reason you're talking about.
Yeah. Senator Cruz, anything?
I like having options in the future, but
we can do it.
Well, here's the thing. The reality is if there's going to be one of these contracts, the contracts are going to be hinged on having this authority because it can't happen. It can't work. It can't function if we're going to get to that point. So, I mean, it's one of those things, and this is something we're not moving today. I want the committee to think about it. Do we want to put something in place on the, let's say, anticipation if in the future, whenever that may be, that everything's in place? If not, then we're going to be having the need for this to be discussed in the future and actually amend then. So I'm going to let everyone have a little time out here and think about it. All right? So with that, gentlemen, thank you very much. Mary, you were on the list. Did you still want to testify? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75. We represent the folks who work both in the counties and at the state facilities. And so this is, you know, this is challenging for us, but let me be very clear. We consider ourselves to be productive partners in these discussions. It is the goal of our members, whether they're working at the local level or at the state level, to get the best system put together for kids and to have the best outcomes with the most resources. My concern is, and our concern is that when you have a five-county consortium that is not made up of small rural counties, but rather is made up of large urban counties who have more resources than our rural counties have, if you take those counties out of the system, then you damage the ability of all the rural counties in Oregon to access the same kinds of programs. And I was trying to think, if Mr. Chair, I think you may be the only person on the committee that was around for the initial beginning of OIA, and our vision was that OIA would provide the same program services and resources to every child in the state of Oregon who needed them, whether they came from Lake County or Multnomah County, that those kids that were at risk and in the system would receive the same level of services. Our goal is to make sure that that continues. And if the counties want to set up some kind of a special deal with OIA, then let them do it in a forthcoming manner. Sit down, put together the contract with the county, and set up measurable goals that that county must reach, and make sure that they're reaching those goals. I have no question, there's no question in my mind that some of the counties can do that. But to secretly put together an amendment that nobody got to see, that nobody knew was coming, is not the stuff that's made up of good communication and forthright behavior. And I underscore everything you said, Mr. Chair. You know, I think if they want to do these things, then let's do it in a way that makes sense, and in a way that allows the sunshine to show on it, and make sure that everybody knows what they're expected to do, and what the cost is if they don't. And let's not balance that cost on the backs of kids who desperately need services, whether they're in Malheur County or in Multnomah County or Lane County. And it sort of feels to me like the arrogance of large counties saying, we know best and we can do it better. You know, I think our members at the county levels can do things that are amazing, but so do our people at the state level. This should not be a tug of war as to who does it better, but rather how do we all do it well? That's my only comment.
Any questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2049. And as I stated, we will bring this back up at some point over the next month after we have an opportunity to have a little bit more thought and conversations with this. Any other comments or thoughts? We're on for tomorrow at 8:30, if I'm not mistaken, and so we are adjourned until then. Thank you.
8:30 was a good choice for today, too.